Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What is it that we do when we know concepts? What does that knowledge consist of?
I've got a feeling deep inside, oh yeah.
Is intuition a guide to truth?
Philosophers want to ask the question, what is justice? What is personal identity? And that may not be a question about the world.
Doesn't knowledge have to start somewhere?
Exactly. We don't really know until we reflect on it. So you need to examine cases, and those cases have to be convincing.
What's your intuition?
Sometimes it is important to try to get clear on certain really basic, pervasive concepts.
Our guest is Alvin Goldman from Rutgers University.
There is a lot of agreement about application of certain concepts to certain cases.
Intuition, a guide to truth, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates across the Bay on a Stanford University campus where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're asking, is intuition a guide to truth?
Well, Ken, that obviously depends on what you mean by intuition. Some people use the word intuition to mean like a premonition or instinct, a gut feeling that doesn't depend on any reasoning. These kinds of intuitions seem not only unreasonable, they can conflict with reason sometimes.
Yeah, I get your point. I get your point, John. But there's another kind of intuition. That does, it's closer to kind of conscious reasoning and thinking. It's let's call it intellectual intuition. Philosophers love this kind of intuition. We use it to figure out what to think about all sorts of things. We develop all these fancy thought experiments to generate and pump our intuition.
Thought experiments like Hillary Putnam's famous brain in the vat thought experiment?
That's a really good one. Now, don't try this at home, okay? It's a little dangerous. You put a brain in a vat. You hook it up to a machine that stimulates that invatted brain in ways that a normal embodied brain is stimulated. And then comes the million-dollar question. Would you know, based only on your experience, can you know, based only on experience, whether you are a brain in a vat or not? Now, John, given that we're hardly going to actually remove somebody's brain and put it in a vat to find out the real answer to this question, all we can do is think about the case that we presented and form an intuition about it.
Well, maybe that's all we could do, but why should we take such intuitions seriously? Why should we take them as to be reliable? We know that sometimes the truth turns out to be very counterintuitive. Like if you were to take a feather and a bowling ball and drop them from a tall building like the Tower of Pisa, which do you think would hit the ground first?
Well, you know, the intuitive answer, the one Aristotle gave, the one many, many people gave for hundreds and thousands of years, is that the hot, heavier object is going to fall faster than the lighter object. It's only intuitive. But you're right, it took Galileo to prove that not only Aristotle, but everybody was wrong about that case.
Exactly. And that's the big difference between science and philosophy.
I don't get where you're going with this.
Well, scientists like Galileo, they may start off with an intuition to suggest what they want to know, but they don't treat that as evidence. They treat it as an occasion to get some evidence. They go out and test their intuitions. And it's the data that they gather in their experiments, dropping the things from the Tower of Pisa. That's what counts as the evidence, not the untutored intuitions. Philosophers, on the other hand, not all of us, but many of us, we like to sit in our armchairs and come to all sorts of conclusions based on intuitions.
You sound like you don't think philosophers have any right to use intuitions as evidence. That can't be.
Well, why should anyone treat their intuitions as evidence of anything other than what they themselves think? And since philosophers disagree with their intuitions, it can't be a very good test for truth because somebody's got to be wrong.
But look, how are we supposed to figure out, say, what the correct moral theory is if we don't allow ourselves to start out with some basic intuitions about what's right and wrong, and then go for that. I'll give you an example. There's a moral theory out there. Here's a crude moral theory. Lying is always wrong. But let's test that. How are we going to test that? Say you're in Nazi Germany, okay? And you've hidden your Jewish neighbors in the attic. The Nazis come knocking on your door demanding to know, do you have any Jews in this house? Well, I'm going to ask you, John, what would be the moral thing to do? Would it be to lie to the Nazis or tell them the truth?
Well, if your intuition says tell the truth, all that proves is that you're an idiot. I mean, why go to all the trouble of hiding people in the attic when the Nazis come, you say where they are? What's the point of that?
No, look, I'm not asking what the smart, non-idiotic thing to do is. I'm asking you what's the moral thing to do.
Well, I would lie. What's your point?
What did you just rely on? You relied on your moral intuition to answer the question, John.
Don't get too excited. I mean, you asked for my opinion, and I gave it. Did I say, here's my intuition? Did I say, here's a universal moral truth? No, I just said what I would do.
But you would lie because you think it's the morally right thing to do, right? And you came to this conclusion based on moral intuition, John. That's how you did it.
Did I? I mean, I would have said common sense. Maybe I just don't know what the difference is. I guess, congratulations, Ken. I mean, you haven't convinced me of anything, but you've confused me, more confused than I was when I started. So, good work.
Okay, John. You know, philosophers, contrary to what you might think, aren't the only ones who make use of intuitions. We're also not the only ones to debate the value of intuition. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to find out more about how other disciplines use intuition. She files this report.
If you ask someone on the street what an intuition is, they're likely to tell you that it's a quick decision or the ability to pick up on things without thinking. Chess masters who instantly know the next move, or baseball players who track the arc of a pop fly.
There's a long drive to deep, deep center field, base back to the wall. It's an incredible catch. Thompson fires it in. What a catch by Willie Mays.
But if you ask a linguist about intuition, look out. It's a heated subject.
It's certainly the case that teaching is in no sense essential to the acquisition of language.
In the 1950s, Noam Chomsky popularized the linguistic notion of intuition as a way to do research.
The primary data for the linguist are our intuitions.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist and professor at UC Berkeley.
So what you do is that you sit there and you kind of roll your eyeballs inward 180 degrees and observe your own intuitions about sentences, and those are the data. And if you like a sentence and you think it's grammatical, you write it down. If you think it's not grammatical, you write it down, you put a little asterisk in front of it.
Chomsky's famous example of using intuition is the sentence, colorless green ideas sleep furiously.
I don't get it.
Let me say it again. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. It's grammatically and intuitively correct, but makes no sense.
There's no other science where the investigator can make up his or her own data without getting some independent verification for it.
Tom Wasso is chair of the linguistics department at Stanford. He's skeptical of research that relies primarily on intuition.
As this debate has heated up, I've squarely taken the side of experimentalists.
The experimentalists are a group of linguists who bring ordinary people into a lab and test intuitions about language. Wasso says this is a good middle ground for linguistic research, mixing previously recorded and collected data on sentences with original research. After all, Wasso says, if linguists call what they do science, they should care about scientific respectability.
I think we should use whatever kind of data we can get for constructing our theories, as long as those data are scientifically respectable.
And as we've learned, for philosophers, intuition is a different story.
When philosophers use the word intuition, often they don't mean what Connie the scientist and what actually the majority of people mean by intuition.
Massimo Piliucci has PhDs in both biology and philosophy and studies the intersection of science and philosophy.
They clearly use it as a shorthand for here is something that I consider to be obvious and I don't want to bother to defend at the moment, with the proviso, of course, that if you really don't find it obvious, I'll go back and I'll defend it.
And philosophers consider these things obvious because they've already thought about them over and over.
When, let's say, You have a toothache. Where do you go? You go to the dentist instead of the mechanic or the philosopher. Why is that? Well, because that's the expert in that field, which, of course, does not mean that the dentist in question is necessarily going to solve your problem. He's not infallible. But you better bet your money that way rather than any other.
Piliucci says philosophers shouldn't worry about giving their own intuitions more credence than those of lay people.
It's not a question of elitism, it's just a question of simply acknowledging that there are domains of expertise within which really the opinion that counts the most is the opinion of the experts.
Experts can think fast or without supporting evidence in the area of their expertise because they've earned it. And maybe figuring out whose intuitions we can rely on for which purposes can help us all get to the truth faster and more easily. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Thanks, Natalie, for reminding us that it's not only philosophers who rely on intuitions. House of cards or stable foundation? We don't know. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of philosophy from Rutgers University. He's author of Pathways to Knowledge, Private and Public. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Alvin Goldman.
Alvin, you started off your career in philosophy, Thinking About Action, at least your first book, a classic in my opinion, A Theory of Actions. How did you get from there to thinking about intuition? I mean, was that a topic in the Philosophy of Action book that I missed? Or did you just have a premonition you could make a fortune about writing about intuition?
Well, the term wasn't used in the book, and it wasn't widely used at that time by philosophers generally. But I would trace the route as follows, John. When I was starting out in philosophy, I had what turned out to be some fairly unorthodox views of not only in theory of action, but also in epistemology. And to defend unorthodox views or even orthodox views to other philosophers, you have to have examples. You have to have cases. And those cases have to be convincing. So I used some cases in my theory of action book, which helped advance the unorthodox view. And I did similar things in epistemology.
You mean you had a more intuitive theory, so you became a fan of intuitions because your theory was so intuitive?
That's exactly right, Ken. I put forward some examples, and people were surprised by the examples because they conflicted with what the orthodoxy said, but they couldn't escape their admitting that those were intuitive examples.
Well, one of your examples was when you flip a switch, by flipping the switch, you turn on the lights. But you asserted, and I assumed everyone would agree, because it's intuitive, that you wouldn't say, by turning on the light, you flip the switch. But before we get too far into the philosophy of action, Ken and I made this distinction between two categories of intuition, one which we called gut feelings, and the other one which we called intellectual intuitions. I suppose if you were to ask me in those days whether by turning on the light I flipped a switch, and I'd say, no, that would be an intellectual intuition. I don't know if it's a gut feeling or not. But do you have a more nuanced way of carving up the area of intuitions that we should adopt?
Well, from my point of view, the most common use of intuitions in philosophy is what I would call classification judgments. That is, philosophers generally are really after — this is not the only thing they're after, but this is one of the main things they're after — what kinds of things, I'll just call them things for now, what properties they have. So take justice, or take knowledge, or take causation. Philosophers are interested in saying, what is that? What is justice? And of course, if you've got a good theory of what justice is, then you'll be able to apply it to the real world. If you've got a case of what causal relations are, then you can apply that to the real world. So you want a theory, but to get to the theory, you need to examine cases, and that's where the intuition is.
This goes way back to Plato and Socrates and Aristotle. Socrates went around saying, well, what is justice? And testing people's intuitive judgments, and then trying to show that their intuitive judgments would get them in all kinds of trouble because they didn't really know what justice is. But that's a different story. But this is Philosophy Talk. coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is Alvin Goldman from Rutgers University, and we're thinking about intuition.
Should you trust intuition? Do your intuitions reveal the truth about the world or language or anything? Or do they just reveal the contents of your own mind?
Intuition, truth, and evidence, along with questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Alvin Goldman from Rutgers University, and we're asking whether intuition is a guide to truth.
When do you rely on intuition? Do you try to test your intuitions? Do you treat them with skepticism, or do you just trust them completely? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, Alvin, philosophers in our philosophical arguments, we rely on intuitive judgments a lot more than linguists do, even. But it's not clear, it's really not clear to me, that intuitions are a good way to gain real knowledge about the world. I mean, think of John's example about our intuitions about gravity. Tell us, so you tell me, can intuitions ever count as evidence for a claim?
Well, whether intuitions can count as evidence for a claim, some kind of claim, is one thing. Whether it can count as evidence for things in the world is a different question. That's a very tough question, and personally, I'm not prepared to say for sure that it does. But go back to the kinds of topics we were talking about earlier and that you were mentioning examples from Plato. We can mention examples from John Locke, who talked about what is personal identity using intuitions, whether you would think people who've made a brain exchange are the same person as a certain predecessor with whom they've exchanged a brain. So philosophers want to ask the question, what is personal identity? But what exactly does that mean? Does that mean what is our concept or what is your concept of personal identity? That may not be a question about the world. What is the predicate identity in persons? What does that mean?
It seems like what we always need to, suppose we're just interested in something mundane like chickens, right? We want to know what's important about chickens? We want to do some research on chickens. We want to get a grant from the National Chicken Institute. Well, it seems like we have to start with some agreement about chickens. That these are chickens. Those are geese. Those are ducks. These are chickens.
And we have to start with the assumption that we know that that's a chicken.
Yeah.
But what is it that we do when we know that it's a chicken? What does that knowledge consist of?
Oh, that's your question. Because you're an epistemologist.
Isn't that just relatively superficial knowledge, that that's what I and people like me call chickens? You really don't know any more than that when you've got these chickens together, right?
Because I love John's example from the opening. Think about gravity. Okay, we have a concept of gravity. Oh, our concept of gravity, or maybe we didn't have one, but after Newton we did. Oh, that's what makes stuff fall. But you're not going to find out anything else about gravity from examining our concept of gravity. You're going to have to examine the fundamental metaphysics of the world to understand gravity. So, okay, we might have a concept of chicken. Oh, those are chickens, those chickens, that chicken. But are you going to find out anything really deep about chickens, like about their biology or something, or how they reproduce
You're not going to find anything deep about chickens unless you've got a group of chickens to start that everybody agrees that those are intuitively chickens.
So what do you think of?
Let's apply this to the case of causation. Now, causation is something we think of as being in the world. But we also want to distinguish between certain kinds of relations that we call causation. So there is some element of how we conceptualize these matters and which things we classify that occur in the world. There's no current doubt that they occur in the world. But how do we classify them? What do we want to do with them? That often depends on our conceptualization and of our language. And that's what a part of what philosophers are after. They're not only after that. They're really interested in the relationship between all of these things.
Well, let me just continue my chicken example. I mean, so, suppose we agree these are chickens, and then a philosopher says, now, how about this, though? Now, this looks like a chicken, but it was actually came from that duck's egg. There was a story about this, the story of the ugly duckling or something. Or how about this? It looks like a chicken, but it's actually something that was just generated by spontaneous combustion. So it seems like there's first-order intuitions that we need to get started, and then lots of times philosophers say, well, intuitively that's not a chicken because it didn't come from a chicken egg, or intuitively it is a chicken because it looks like a chicken. These second-order intuitions seem to me very problematic because they just seem like people's reactions. But don't we need that first-order? Don't we have to assume some competence that people have in the use of their language to even get started with asking what is justice, what's a chicken, what is it to fall?
Sure, that's fine. I mean, if you want to justify the use of intuitions to that extent, maybe that's fine. It's where we start focusing on the hard problems, where we're thinking about somewhat intellectual concepts often, but they're used by everyday people. And these turn out to be infused in our culture, in our institutions. So the law will often take certain stances about certain concepts as to harms being done. And it doesn't want to make decisions that are totally out of kilter with how we understand these in ordinary life.
Okay, let me try something out. So philosophers are sort of like anthropologists in the following way. Suppose you're an anthropologist. You come across a tribe of people. You've never encountered them before. And they're using a bunch of words, and they're deploying a bunch of concepts. And you want to figure out, oh, gosh, what do these concepts mean? So what would you do if you were an anthropologist? You say, well, is this a pupa? Or is this a pupa? Right? And they say, oh, yeah, pupa. And you say, well, is this another pupa? They say, no, pupa, you know? Kind of, so you'd figure out by giving them a bunch of cases, and then you might think, well, let's see. I don't have all the possible pupas there are, but I'm going to describe some possible pupas, some possible scenarios. Here's a scenario. Would that be a pupa scenario or not? So philosophers are kind of like anthropologists. Is that right?
There is a resemblance there. So sometimes it is important to try to get clear, and this is a lot of what philosophy is doing, as I've been saying, to try to get clear on certain really basic, pervasive concepts. And the way to do it is exactly by example.
So some people, though, think philosophy is a bankrupt enterprise because of this kind of endeavor. That fellow who hosts Cosmos, the astrophysicist, what's his name?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
He said, he's the guy, he made a bunch of philosophers upset. He said, philosophers, all they do is sit in their armchair, examine their intuitions, examine meanings. I'm trying to figure out how nature works. Philosophy has nothing to teach us about how nature works. So if we're just sitting there thinking, is this a pupa? Is that a pupa? Does that tell us anything about how pupas work? You know, how they come to be and all that sort of stuff?
I am not one to argue that intuitions will tell you about how things work. But the question about how things work is not the only interesting question in the world. So since we believe there are persons and we make a lot of decisions that are important in legal contexts about what is a person, philosophers take it on to be important, and in political life we take it on to be important what counts as a person and when do persons start to exist. So these are important questions in our lives, and they're not straightforward questions of empirical physical science.
Now, is it that you think, so with the anthropologists approaching that tribe, we don't really know what they're thinking when they think about pupas. We have to figure it out. So when we think about knowledge or persons, are you saying that we're kind of in the same position with respect to ourselves that we are with respect to that alien tribe? We don't really know what our concept of a person is just instantly. We've got to give ourselves a bunch of kind of puzzling cases.
Exactly. We don't really know until we reflect on it and deal with cases. So knowledge is something we talk about all the time. The verb know is one of the most common verbs in the English language. But that doesn't mean that when we say, well, we want to start a new university here that will, which will engender more knowledge in a larger percentage of the population, what exactly are we after? What is that knowledge that we want universities or our schools generally to achieve? And why do we want to achieve that? We need a more precise specification.
But what science does, go back to John's example, it takes intuitions as a starting point, and then it sharpens them and sharpens them. Take solidity. We used to think, oh, solid things, they dense everywhere, and they resist encroachment. And we thought that was one thing. Well, it turns out they're not totally dense. They're mostly empty. They still resist encroachment. Was there a solidity or was there not? Yeah, science gives us new concepts. Philosophers work with,
yeah,
I don't know.
But as Sal says, there's a lot of questions that are not really scientific questions. Take, for example, marriage. We've had a big debate about what marriage is. Now, is Neil deGrasse Tyson going to kind of look through his telescope and say, oh, it turns out gay marriage is okay because the proton, blah, blah, blah. No, it really is a question, a complicated question about the use of words, about institutions, about history, and about policy. And some intuitions are involved. Everybody agrees that I and my wife are married. Common law marriages, most people agree on. Gay marriage, a lot of disagreement, conflicting intuitions. I don't know who's qualified, not infallible, but who's qualified to deal with that kind of question more than a philosopher.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about intuitions and whether they're guides to truth with Alvin Goldman from Rutgers University. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we've got a question from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, Dale Bowyer from Oakland. The way I think of intuition is the voice of the unconscious, the more powerful part of your brain that's not limited to rational thought, linear thinking, that's capable of massively parallel processing and of all the absorbed experience that you're not even conscious of. So how does this fit into the concept of intuition that you're all describing? Seemed like you're kind of limiting intuition to more like what I would call inductive reasoning. And I think more of to intuition as kind of the gut feeling that comes out of your whole unconscious.
What do you think about that? There is a use of intuition that's more like that. What
right.
do you think about
so,
that?
Right. So, well, I think the philosopher of intuition should definitely pay heed to the importance of the unconscious. And that could play a constructive role here. So even within the kind of venture that I've been describing, where you're trying to understand really important concepts in more detail, I think we should all assume that the question arises, what's a concept? And I would say that that is a mental representation or very complex representational structure, which is normally completely unconscious. But you occasionally trigger that structure or that unconscious structure if you think about whether this is a case of knowledge or this is a person or whether this would be a case of marriage. But you don't know what's going on. You don't know about the relationship. And then you get a reaction that spontaneously wells up. Yes, it is a case of knowledge, or no, it isn't a case of personal identity.
Yeah, so look, back to the roving philosophical reporter, the linguist use of intuition is much, it's not exactly the same as our questioner's was, but it's really closer because it's not as though I know explicitly what the grammar of my language is, but somehow that unconscious language device is driving those intuitions, not in a conscious, reason-governed way, but by some kind of unconscious mechanism.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying here, that when we use language, but also when we think, then when we trigger any concept, that's some structure which is buried in the brain, and we've got to make some sort of contact with it for present purposes, whatever we're thinking about.
So people who act intuitively, act on unconscious reasons and stuff like that, I mean, maybe they're being driven. I mean, you're interested in concepts and the analysis of concepts because that's what we philosophers do. But suppose I thought about intuitive decision-making. Might it not be parallel? There are these unconscious devices that somehow drive my judgments without my conscious awareness. And the question is, should we trust those things? I mean, is there like a parallel there?
Well, I think one thing we can say is that the reason for trust, applying again to concepts, is that there is a lot of agreement between people about application of certain concepts to certain cases. That's what philosophers discover. There isn't always agreement, but there is often quite a substantial amount of agreement, and that's where the project can make good headway.
Let me give another example. Take riding a bike. Mm-hmm. Now, riding a bike is something most of us know how to do, but we couldn't say how we do it. Mm-hmm. But there's something we've internalized that allows us to ride a bike. And careful observation, you can see what these people have in common. What we do is we steer the direction we're starting to fall in very imperceptible ways. So I think that's the picture linguists have. There's these internal ways of doing things, speaking various languages, that the speakers of that language have internalized. They couldn't tell you what they were, but by observing them, you can get at those rules. And asking them what they would say as opposed to why they would say it, that is asking them for their intuition, is a very valuable part of that. And the question is, to what extent does that apply to things like knowledge and marriage and all these
other
things?
Well, on the surface, I think it applies very precisely, though not necessarily all philosophers would express it that way. So I think that's the right way to view what's going on when philosophers ask, is this a case of knowledge or is it not? It's very analogous to what the linguist is doing. And you can be asking a respondent who has no idea about why he or she is responding one way or the other way. So that's quite analogous to what the language user is doing when answering the question of the linguist. In fact, I might mention parenthetically that it's very likely that the popularity of the term intuition is due to Chomsky's and its use in intuition in philosophy. So philosophers, however, were up on this kind of quest centuries ago.
Yeah, 2,000 years ago. Welcome to Philosophy Talks.
Thank you. John mentioned earlier two different types of categorization of intuition, the gut intuition and intellectual intuition. How do you compare those two in terms of intuitive growth? I mean, you see a lot in sports, people's understanding of space and so forth and how far to go to catch the ball. The notion of intuitive growth, your intuition grows. How do you look at that?
I don't have a good answer to that question, and I don't know of literature either in psychology or in philosophy.
Jason Stanley on know-how. See, he thinks philosophers have over-intellectualized things.
Yes.
And know-how, I mean, a lot of what we know, he thinks is skill-based, is practical knowledge, and we haven't studied that enough. Psychology is starting to get onto it.
Sure.
But, you know, we can address that after a break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about intuition with Alvin Goldman from Rutgers University.
Is there a way to improve your intuitive capacities? Can you become an expert at intuiting? And what happens when the intuitions of experts disagree with one another?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Some money too.
Thanks to our live musical guest, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Alvin Goldman from Rutgers University, and we're asking about the nature of intuitions. Are intuitions a reliable guide to truth? We've got a question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben.
Hi, my name is Laura, and I'm from San Francisco. You talked a little bit already about the concept of a person and how this has very real ramifications in the world, depending on, you know, what we think counts as a person or not. And so let's thinking about abortion and, you know, whether or not the fetus is a person. I mean, one question we could ask is, well, is there a fact of the matter, whether or not it is or is not a person? And it seems like we can't figure that out. If there is, it's not something we're going to discover empirically. Like, what kind of test could we do? So then what do we do? Well, you know, if you have a certain background and a certain religion, maybe your intuition says it is a person. And if you have a different background, maybe you say, well, it's not a person. And then what? How do we settle this other than saying, well, you know, you've got one intuition, I've got another, and we're never going to see eye to eye on that?
Well, there definitely are going to be cases where people have different concepts. And if we're trying to get what is the common concept, then we may run into cases where it's just not determinate because some people have understand it in one way and other people understand it another. And I don't have any particular prescriptions for how to go about doing that. But what about all the cases where people agree? Isn't that telling us something about what it is that they cognitively share in which they express that term?
I think that's a good, that was a good question. You're making a good point in response to that question, but maybe I'm feeling scientistic today. Because one of the things that science does for us, it doesn't just, Wittgenstein used to say, you know, our language is perfectly in order as it is. And sometimes philosophy strikes me as thinking, well, we've got these concepts and our job is to analyze these concepts. And you do that through the thought experiments and all that sort of stuff. But there's another part of me that says, oh, yeah, we got these concepts, but what are these concepts for? They're for cognizing the world adequately. So maybe we have a concept of person that, like, is not good enough. So maybe we need to revise it. Maybe we need to put our concepts to stress testing. Maybe we need to think about how best to improve them to capture the most systematic general explanations. That's what science does. Or at least one thing it does.
How's science going to do that with the concept of person?
Well, I don't know how they're going to do that with the concept of person, but the concept of person has a role in our lives, and we need a concept that plays that role in a way that enables us to rationally debate and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, what about the revision of concepts rather than just the analyzing of concepts?
Seems to me there is no one good theory of that. But let me point out, to give a little more balance here, that not all philosophers think, who believe in working with intuitions, think that they're addressed to concepts. Some of them would say that they're addressed to understanding certain properties or relations that exist in the world. So, for example, the property or relation of causation. That's something that presumably obtains quite independently of our concepts of it, and there isn't any question, or is there, about wanting to revise the concept.
Well, maybe there is, because you might think our old-fashioned concept is, well, Aristotle thought he analyzed the concept of cars. Descartes thought he had concept of cars. Quantum theory comes along, right? The Big Bang comes along. You know, it's now all like billiard balls bumping. Now what is, it's superpositions of positions and all this stuff. Now what, does our concept of cars have a hold on reality?
That suggests a problem with relying on the scientists. You rely on the scientists. I mean, we have the concept of causation. We use it in the law. We use it in everyday work. We tell people, you do this, you might cause yourself to have cancer. It's a very useful concept that does a lot of work in a huge amount of human endeavor. And then the science come and say, oh, well, but at the most basic level of reality, there is no causation. Oh, and by the way, time goes out the window, too. Well, how the hell is that helpful, right? I mean, it begs for a philosopher to come along and try to explain how come, even though there isn't causation at the lowest level of quantum theory, it's still a useful concept. Or so I would think. How about you, Al?
What would you think?
Well, actually, philosophers will, these days, I think, would say there are many concepts of causation. There are many, many ways of distinguishing types of causation. So there's no one thing, and there's no one thing that we can expect science to provide for.
How about the concept of an event that you and Anscombe and Davidson and
that's came that's up another
with?
Very
that's different. There's one concept of event, and it's a combination of properties and objects and times, right?
Well,
no, actually, I've revised my view that those are compatible. There are both things.
So look, I do think that what this shows is, briefly, that as if we think of philosophy as kind of cognitive anthropology or akin to cognitive science, the study of intuitive judgments is really important and deep.
Absolutely.
You and I totally agree. I also believe with a Neil Tyson whatever, but I can't ever remember his name.
You're blocking it.
He pisses me up. You know? But I do agree with the critique that says, if you want to know about what the world is like, take these intuitive judgments as no more than starting points subject to wide-scale revision in light of the advancement of empirical inquiry.
Okay, but I think he's arguing against a straw man, because no sensible philosopher would say that philosophy is wholly constituted by study of intuition.
Yeah, that's why he pisses me off.
So that's what this particular show on this particular occasion is addressed to is only a slice of philosophy.
Right, exactly.
Okay? But I think Tyson, one thing that bothers physicists is they put out some theory like, you know, the Big Bang. And then you ask an innocent remark like, well, what happened before the Big Bang? And they get all upset and they say, you just don't understand the mathematics of it. Well, what's really upsetting them is it's a perfectly reasonable question.
And they don't know how to answer it. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Steve from Oakland. Often you hear intuition called the sixth sense. What's the relationship between intuition and the five senses that we use all the time for empirical knowledge? It seems that what we're talking about is how do those things interact? Any opinions?
Well, my own view would be that when it comes to concept classification of types, that's classification of examples with respect to types, that something analogous is going on inside the mind as goes on in perception. Namely, that there's some, as I said, representational structure which represents a concept, which could be expressed in a phrase, a linguistic predicate of some sort, and it's stored somehow in the brain. And when a term that expresses that is used in application to an example, then what the mind does is, first of all, make some sort of a grab onto that representation of the concept, which is something like perception, but it's inside, what is being perceived is inside the mind. And then some comparison is made between the content of that object that has been grabbed and the instance which has been produced by the philosopher to ask, is that an instance of the type?
Yeah, think of it this way, just really brief, just to add on. Right? Look, the mind does all kinds of things rather than just directly perceive. It imagines. It engages in counterfactual reasoning. It thinks hypothetically. Intuition, this sort of philosophical intuition, is tied up with, well, let me see if I can get you to imagine that, say, a black human being has dignity, right? So I'm thinking of the slave owners who would deny the humanity of a black. Can you imagine that if you weren't holding them as slaves? So I get you to imagine things using these concepts. I get you to dream of counterfactual possibilities. And it's all, like you said, inside the mind, not tied to perception, but its relation to perception is very similar. I mean, it has something.
It's a kind of interoception.
Yeah.
But right. That is a kind that can be viewed as a kind of perception. So that's one relationship I see.
Let's take the one last question. Welcome to Philosophy
Talk. This man is wearing a Philosophy Talk t-shirt, so we will take his question.
And if we have to edit out other people's, I'm sorry.
My name is Peter, and I live in Berkeley. And I was thinking about this straw man that you're mentioning, that the straw man that science is totally philosophers think that science is all about intuition. But that made me think about a legal system. Any legal system has to be entirely underpinned by intuition. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think the legal system being, you know, existing in the practical world has to make contact with the people whose system it is and has to express their understandings of certain kinds of things, of property, of interpersonal relations, of what is a harm done by one to another. So done by one to another, that itself involves the causal relation. So they have to build on some understanding of causal relations that may not be sensitive to the most contemporary physics, but nonetheless has to be workable in some way in the world in which we live. So that's the sense.
It shouldn't just be the fantasy of one superannuated Supreme Court justice who's overweight and irritating.
Is that easy to agree with?
So Al, give us your last closing thought about the philosophical use of intuition. Some people say boo, some people say hooray. You seem to have a kind of in-between voice, kind of.
Maybe ole, ole.
That's right. So I want to distinguish between two questions. Are intuitions good evidence for what they plausibly purport to be good evidence for? And how can we find out whether they're good evidence? And with respect to the second question, I want to say cognitive science can play an important role there because it studies our concepts, how we can maybe go wrong with using even our own concepts. What are the possibilities for error here that would maybe undercut the program, which is up for grabs in my view? So it's a sort of exchange between science, but in this case, more psychological, cognitive science rather than physical science, and what philosophers want to do independently for their own various reasons.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. I mean, I think it's really important for our profession, especially, I don't know about the common folk, but for us, it's an important thing to get right, and there's lots more we could say about it, but we're out of time, and I'm going to thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Alvin Goldman, professor of philosophy at Rutgers University, author of Pathways to Knowledge, Private and Public. So, John, you got any intuitions for me today? I mean, what are your intuitions?
Well, I think it is quite a fascinating and central subject to philosophical methodology. I'm inclined to think that intuitions are a real solid and central part of philosophy, but what they're intuitions of? Timeless Platonic entities that we grasp the structure of in some non-sensory way, or just more like Al thinks, the internal workings of our acculturated mind, we probably haven't completely solved.
I think you're right. I think this is a really, really deep thing, because again, Al talked about concepts, but I'm not sure that what they really track are just concepts, isolated concepts, rather than bundles of theory enculturated somehow, possibly true, possibly false, possibly full of bias and misinformation. So, I mean, I think...
That's inspiring.
I think, well, finding out what they are is the first thing, you know, what our intuitive judgments are, but then settling what they show, well, that's the really hard thing. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, I've got a hunch, an intuition, that Ian Scholes, a 60-second philosopher, has a thing or two to tell us about intuition.
Ian Scholes, intuition is an apparently simple thing that actually is confusing and complicated. Well, that seems counterintuitive, but intuition means so many different things to different people, anything from common sense to sixth sense, an obvious truth, a shrewd guess, a gut feeling, folk wisdom, a core assumption. And capitalism, bless his ugly heart, uses intuition in all its guises. So we get a culture that flatters and manipulates us. But many capitalist premises, even after years of practice, are based on faulty assumptions and bomb. Those shoes with actual five toes, like a glove for a foot, whose intuition was that? And why? Some intuitions and beliefs are just creepy blips of history, like racism, homophobia. Remember back when everything was a paradigm shift? And that didn't mean an industrial revolution. It meant being able to order dog food online. No actual paradigms were shifted. The new paradigm shift is called disruptive innovation, or disruption for short. Everybody's excited about disruption, which seems counterintuitive to me. When I was a kid, if you disrupted the class, you got punished. Today, if you disrupt a class, you get startup money from a billionaire libertarian to drop out of school. Facebook paid $14 billion for WhatsApp, a phone messaging app. My intuition was to say, gee whiz, Facebook, that's a lot of money. On the other hand, the cost for the California high-speed rail, approved by voters, has now gone up to over $90 billion. And pundits want an Intuit. One critic of the high-speed rail is superstar entrepreneur Elon Musk. Famously, he did a quick luncheon prototype on a tablet of what he thinks a transportation system would be. Just off the top of his head, it had to do with sticking people in pneumatic tubes and shooting them through tunnels. Even this idea was pretty much the virtual equivalent of scribbling on a napkin. The internet went nuts for it. Disrupt trains! Let's stick people in tubes and blow them to L.A. Let's spend billions on that. Is it safe? Who cares? One of the lures of disruption is its disregard for regulations. Who needs them? So the train is increasingly viewed as a huge waste of money, even though at the end of the day, you'll have a train. But WhatsApp was not a waste of money, even though at the end of the day, no train. Take two recent hot tech thingies, Uber and Airbnb. Uber is a service to which you can order a car to take you where you want to go. My intuition says it's a taxi. Is it? No. It's totally different because you get it on your smartphone. It's not a taxi. It disrupts taxis. And Airbnb lets you rent your house or apartment. This is called the sharing economy. Now, people are as excited about that as they are about disruption. This also seems counterintuitive. If you're charging money, how is that sharing? It's more of a renting economy. And again, if we're aiming for a tech utopia in which we'll be billionaires free to spend our waking hours munching kale and tanning, well, I don't know much about capitalism, but I do know that renting out your apartment is not the path to unfold riches. Yet, strangely, the people who had the idea for you to rent out your joint are on the path to untold riches. Intuitively, shouldn't we be designing personal moon rockets or something? At least at the end of the day, we'd have a train or a tube or something. Just finding a stranger in my apartment at the end of the day, frankly, the money's all right, but It's kind of depressing. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Erica Sokolauer-Shane, Elise Sugarman, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio for San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed, or perhaps misexpressed in this program, do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.